On Tech News Today, Congress gets banned from the Wikipedia again, and we'll tell you why. Plus, the anonymous app Secret turns out to be less anonymous than we thought, and we'll tell you how companies are using sound to send data. Tech News Today is coming up right now.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Friday, August 22nd, 2014. This episode is brought to you by Lynda.com. Lynda.com is an easy and affordable way to help you learn. Instantly stream thousands of courses created by experts on business, software, web development, graphic design, and more. For a free trial, visit lynda.com/TNT. That's LYNDA.com/TNT. And by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free 2-week trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code TNT. Tech News Today is the show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. Welcome to the show. I'm Mike Elgin. With me is Jason Howell.
Hello, sir.
That's how you say it in France.
Jason.
Jason,
or
yeah.
When I was in Montreal, it was Jackson.
No,
but one person called me Jackson.
I don't believe that.
That's true. One person did call me Jackson, and she was very French Canadian. I think it was kind of like her thing, though. So
that's pretty cool. Yeah, that's twice in the last week or two that we've talked about Canada. We're gonna have to do the show in Canada one of these days.
Hey, we have to throw a bone to the folks up north, right? At least once or twice a week.
So. We do. And also, it's Friday, and today our guest co-anchor is Christina Warren, the senior tech editor at Mashable and media pundit. Welcome, Christina Warren.
Thank you.
Now, you've written about Xiaomi recently, about how they copy everything Apple does. Well, today I've learned that they're also copying the Sapphire thing. They're going to do a limited edition launch of about 50,000 phones with Sapphire. Is there anything that Apple does that they don't copy?
Well, let's see. Let's go through the list. So they copy the entire design of the MIUI. They copy what the CEO wears. He wears a black turtleneck and jeans. They say there's one more thing. They have the Mi Pad, the Mi Phone, the Mi TV, and now they're going to do the Sapphire thing. So no, I don't think there is, except maybe it's possible that Mi Cloud might not be as bad as iCloud was in its early days. Mm. Maybe. I don't know. Mm. So maybe that would be my big question. Do they copy the areas where Apple kind of falls flat? How good is their voice assistant? How good is their cloud service? But anything else? Yeah, I mean, I think even the design of their router, their router looks exactly like the Apple Magic trackpad.
Wow, that's incredible. I think their next phone should be called the Mi 2. That's just me.
That's good.
Let's jump into the news. The U.S. House of Representatives has been banned from editing the Wikipedia again, according to a report by The Hill's Julian Hatem. Julian joins us now to explain. Welcome, Julian.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Now, why was the House banned from editing the Wikipedia this time?
Sure. So this is actually the third time this summer this has happened. And what happened this time is presumably some staffer acting anonymously from the House IP address edited a bunch of pages on Wikipedia that had to do about transgender issues. There are a string of things, including the page for a tranny, for transphobia, a number of comments that a lot of other editors and administrators on Wikipedia thought were kind of offensive. And the final straw earlier this week was when the person edited the page for the TV show Orange is the New Black, which features an actor who's trans. And the original characterization of that actor was a, quote, real transgender woman that was changed to a real man pretending to be a woman. And for administrators at Wikipedia, that was kind of too far. And they said this was abuse and transphobic and really went beyond the pale. So this time they've banned this one IP address. It's not the entire house, but it's one IP address, presumably encapsulating a large number of Hill staffers for a month. And they cannot edit the page anonymously. They cannot edit Wikipedia anonymously at all. And it's, a problem. A looks really, really bad for Congress to be engaging in this kind of silly back and forth, presumably. And it also, in terms of transparency, it's not very good. A lot of transparency advocates say that Wikipedia should be a place where Congress can go to talk about what they're doing, but it doesn't help their cause if they're inciting flame wars and things like this.
So here's my question for you. Do we have any sense of who is making these edits? I mean, I know that in the Wikilogs, the person was claiming to be working for a staffer. But if you look at the history of these edits and some of the other edits, I mean, my first thought is, okay, this is interns who are bored and are deciding to troll Wikipedia. But do we have any sense of anyone who, has anyone come forward to you know, claim their identity of what congressman they're working for or what their role in the House is when they're making these edits?
No, there has not been. They are, you know, still anonymous. And as you say, it is intern season here. There's and it's recess also on Capitol Hill. So there aren't any lawmakers actually in the Capitol. So there's a good chance that this could be interns who have kind of gone a little bit far afield, a little bit out of head of their skis here. But as you noted in this talk pages, these behind the scene page on Wikipedia, they said that they were explicitly authorized to be promoting their lawmakers' message on Wikipedia and things like this. So there's some indication that they are have some kind of tacit approval from the lawmakers, but it's so far relatively anonymous, at least as it refers to these instances. Some Hill staffers have tried to be more kind of out front and transparent, but those are not the ones getting in trouble.
The idea that it's a staffer or an intern is probably a reasonably safe assumption, but who knows? It could be the House Majority Leader. We really don't know. We have no idea. Isn't it kind of draconian to ban an entire IP address? I mean, don't they have other methods? They caught the changes. They reversed them. I guess the question is the House being treated or is this case being treated differently than any other sort of IP address or any other sort of anonymous edit like this?
And that is also kind of a concern. Some people have really been coming to the House's defense saying, you know, hey, guys, this is a little broad. What you could do is, you know, lock the page, which is what they do sometimes about controversial pages so that no one can edit it, or, you know, give some more warnings. But I think one of the ideas is this is not just an isolated incident. Aside from these edits about the trans issues, there are also a number of seeming kind of practical jokes played earlier in this summer. There's this Twitter account at Congress Edits, which updates every time someone from a congressional IP address edits Wikipedia. And it seemed like a bunch of staffers were just going on to make kind of joke edits so that it would show up in that Twitter account. Things like Choco Taco was a big thing that was kind of funny. Also, like moon landing conspiracy theories. And so it seemed like there's a string here. There's a pattern, at least, of kind of abusing the system and of not playing by the rules that it looks like administrators wanted to deal something about. And I talked to the administrator who banned the IP address, and they say, really, what this is trying to do is send a message that we want you to edit Wikipedia. We want you to come and talk about what you and your lawmakers are doing, but not anonymously. And we want you to, like, you know, make an account and log in and have some kind of accountability there so that you're not just, you know, some random intern or staffer or who knows what, and that you can come and defend yourself and be accountable for what you do.
So do we know, has anyone started to do this to any of the other wikis, you know, Conservapedia or anything like that? Or is it just the main Wikipedia that we've seen this sort of activity on?
So far, it's just this main Wikipedia, at least what I've seen. I mean, but that certainly could change. I mean, you know, Congress is very, very good at flame wars and, you know, throwing talking points back and forth. So we'll see if this kind of back and forth just, you know, metastasizes, I guess.
Julian Hatem writes at thehill.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at JM Hatem. That's Hattem. Thank you so much for joining us on Tech News Today.
Thanks a lot. Happy Friday.
All right. You too. Well, in just a minute, we're going to tell you about how the Secret app may not be so secret. But first, I want to tell you about Lynda.com. If you're watching this show, you like to be the smartest kid in the class, and Lynda.com is a great way to do that. It's a place where you can go and pay only $25 a month, not for a class, not for 10 classes, but for unlimited access to more than 100,000 video tutorials on all kinds of professional topics and also topics that may be of personal interest to you. So, for example, if you're a professional, if you're a software engineer, if you're a designer, if you're in business or marketing, there are dozens and dozens and dozens of courses by professionals, professionally developed video tutorials with fully developed curriculum in each of those areas. And so this is a great way for you to really master your profession and be more successful in your career. But in my case also, in addition to professional development, I like Lynda.com for personal development. For example, I love taking pictures. I have a really expensive camera. I have an audience on Google Plus that likes to look at pictures. And I've been taking photography classes here and there my whole life, but now I'm really learning how to do it at lynda.com. And it's just it's a joy to learn because the instructors are so knowledgeable. You normally wouldn't have access to instructors of this caliber unless you live in a major city or in a place where these kinds of experts congregate. But you can access lynda.com, obviously, from anywhere that you can get online. So lynda.com is just the most fantastic resource for anyone who wants to develop themselves and learn in a very, very cost-effective and very, very efficient way with high-quality instructors. For any software you rely on, lynda.com can help you stay current with all the software updates, and you can also learn the ins and outs to be more efficient and productive. So if you're just a computer enthusiast as well, it's a great way to really master everything that's going on in technology. And we've got a special offer for people who want to access all the courses free for 7 days. That's right. You can try it free for 7 days, and you can binge learn. Visit lynda.com/TNT to try lynda.com for free. That's lynda.com/TNT. Well, the whole point of the app Secret is anonymity. But now a security consultant named Brian Seely's figured out how to know who sends secret posts. Seth Rosenblatt wrote about the story for CNET and joins us now. Welcome, Seth.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going great. Now, before anybody freaks out that the things that they've posted are out there and everybody knows who wrote them, the vulnerability has been fixed, right?
Oh, yes. So Seely stuck to the standard practices of responsible disclosure. So he approached Secret after he found the hack. And they fixed it. And then now that it's been fixed, he's coming forward with them and describing how it was done.
So how was it done? What went into figuring out what users on Secret were posting and you know, tracing back the post to a specific user?
Sure. So this was actually a more of a social engineering hack than a technological hack or a vulnerability in the code somewhere. What he did, basically, Secret has three levels of sharing, right? It has your friends. It tells you when a post comes from a friend. It tells you when a post comes from a friend of a friend. And it tells you when a post comes from a stranger. And Seely was able to exploit that by creating a number of dummy accounts that all had other dummy accounts as their contact in their contact lists. So they looked like legitimate users, except for the one target. And the target in the contact list would be a real person. Seely told me that he wound up using the contact info for the CEO, David Bytow, of Secret.
Now,
Very interesting. The
story about how you about how this came about how Seely convinced Bytow that this was a real problem is really interesting. Can you tell us that story?
Sure. So Seely had figured out this hack, and he got a hold of David Bytow's contact information so that it looked like they were friends, you know, because he was in his contact list. And because there were no other legitimate contacts in the dummy accounts, whenever Bytow posted to Secret, Seely knew that it had to be Bytow because the dummy accounts weren't posting. So he took a screenshot of one of Bytow's posts and sent him an email and said, this is you.
And so obviously after he responsibly disclosed, what did Secret do? How have they fixed this problem? Because as you noted, I mean, this is a pretty unique kind of social engineering trick. So what has Secret done to prevent this sort of thing from happening before if you have a dummy account with just, you know, one specific target's information?
Sure. So one of the things is that Secret would not go into detail about how they fixed it.
It's a secret.
It's a secret. But they did say, Bytow did tell me that the method that Seely used to do this hack was actually discovered in May, and he didn't tell me why they didn't fix it until after Seely approached him. But they've basically fixed it so that when a dummy account is created, it sets off alerts. And so you have to have a new threshold that prevents new accounts from being created too rapidly.
Seth Rosenblatt writes at CNET.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Seth R. Thank you so much for joining us, Seth Rosenblatt.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
Right. Thank you. Well, the best company to work for out of all the companies in America is, drumroll please, Twitter. at least according to a new report by Glassdoor. Alice Truong is Fast Company's West Coast correspondent and a contributor to USA Today, and she wrote about the Glassdoor report for Fast Company. Welcome, Alice.
Thanks for having me.
Twitter, really?
Yeah, people quite enjoy it. Actually, since the report went live this morning, I've been seeing a number of different tweets where people, you know, mention, oh, I started having to grow, like, comb my hair, but I still really enjoy it. I think that the best company to work for is very subjective. Obviously, this report was looking at the company culture, according to former and current Twitter employees. Glassdoor comes out with a lot of different reports. They have a ton of data as a result of these anonymous reviews. Some of the more fun ones I recall are, you know, of course, the top salaries of across the board in Silicon Valley. And one that I think is perhaps the most interesting one I've encountered is a report about interns that make more than the U.S. household or median household income. And that got a lot of interesting reaction, a lot of life evaluation, I believe. So anyway, the people like Twitter for a number of reasons. I scanned through some of the reviews. People really like the food. People talk about, you know, gaining 20 pounds. The free beer is nice. So are the rooftop meetings.
So they're all basically stuffing their faces and getting drunk and then voting about what a great company it is.
I mean, why wouldn't you like working there, right?
Right, exactly. It sounds like Twit.
So technology companies, in addition to Twitter, they had a pretty strong presence on this list. Does that say anything, do you think? Or is that, do you think, maybe because of Glassdoor's, the fact that it is a technology company in and of itself and a website, do you think that that means that tech companies are represented maybe more because of maybe inherent bias into the people who use Glassdoor? Or what do you think that means, that there are a lot of tech companies on the list?
I do think it's a bit of both. I feel like Glassdoor isn't just a resource for people who work in tech. You know, people I know across various industries do consult it when they are job hunting. But, you know, Silicon Valley has a very strong reputation for its perks. Hiring is crazy competitive out here, and everyone complains about the difficulty and challenges of hiring a good engineer. And so you do need to make yourself very appealing and kind of quirky in some way to lure them in. So, you know, Google is very famous for starting this. And I feel like for any company that has, you know, that has a fair amount of money to spend, especially on like acquisition, they will definitely focus on the culture, building that up and making these perks, like making people want to come to work, right? Or making them never want to leave because, you know, the food's there, the beer's there, you know, ideally all of their friends are their coworkers. And so, you know, they give their life to the company.
Now, Apple made number 15 on the list, which is kind of a surprise. Can Apple CEO Tim Cook take credit for that? I mean, the company was pretty much a pressure cooker under Steve Jobs, wasn't it?
It's true. I found that a little surprising as well, because people do talk about, you know, the very intense culture at Apple. But I think that looking at the reviews, it seems like people do really appreciate the design aesthetic and the emphasis on creating an amazing, beautiful product and sharing that common goal. And I think that in itself will drive people. Like, a lot of people obviously appreciate that. That's the reason why they're drawn to Apple. So maybe Tim Cook can take some responsibility for this. But I do think that it's Apple's, you know, reputation for focusing on building these great products that really draws the employees. People really appreciate that there are very smart people that they're working with, and people who are very intelligent, very passionate about what they're doing. And that obviously contributes to the culture as well.
So Apple has a lot of smart people, and they're really proud of the design aesthetic and the brilliant products they make. But if they want to move up beyond 15, I think they're going to have to serve beer too. So we'll see how that goes.
Beer.
Beer is the secret. Alice Truong is at fastcompany.com and also alicetruong.com. That's alicetruong.com. And you can follow her on Twitter at Alice Truong. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Have a good weekend.
You too. Everyone knows there's a tiny number of devices on the market running iOS. What, 2 iPhones and maybe 4 iPads for a total of 6 devices. But how many Android devices are on the market? A new report from OpenSignal says the number is 18,796 individual devices that developers have to contend with. And Christina Warren, this is a brutal thing. I'm going to use the F word, fragmentation. And the Open Signal says this is it's worse now by far than it's ever been before.
That's very interesting. I think that they're saying that it's worse now than it's ever been before. It seemed like we maybe crossed a point once, Gingerbread was no longer the dominant operating system, that more and more people were starting to target the 4.0 X series devices. But yeah, I mean, that's a humongous number. And I have to wonder, if you're developers, how do you pick and choose what are you going to develop for and what are you going to ignore?
So just a sense of how this is changing. In 2012, the number was 3,997, basically 4,000. Last year, the number was about 11,868. And so it's increased by 7,000 devices since just last year. That is a big change. Now, it also has to be said that there are a couple of other things that are happening here. Now, one of them is that in China and elsewhere around the world, there are a lot of devices that aren't really, they're not really bona fide approved Android devices, and many of them are not phones. So there's been an explosion in the use of Android for the Internet of Things type devices and also for wearable computing devices. And so those are being counted here, but those don't contribute to the smartphone fragmentation problem that developers have to contend with. It also has to be said that for the most part, developers seem pretty happy. I mean, these numbers seem to indicate a horrible problem that is just impossible to deal with. But in fact, we know that that it's really not that big of a problem. Android developers launch products all the time. They work great on just about any of the major devices. And it's so, you know, really, Christina, do you really think this problem is being exaggerated by these numbers?
Yeah, I definitely think the numbers are exaggerating things. For one, as you mentioned, you know, Android is used on so many different types of devices. I've been making the joke for years that only a few people will probably get that, you know, Android is the new busy box. You know, it's basically become the de facto embedded operating system for a lot of devices. But also, you know, even if you have X number of devices that are all technically different, many times they're running the same exact hardware. So it has the exact same system on a chip, the same integrated GPU, the same type of RAM, and probably even the same screen. So it might count as a different device, but it's actually, you know, inside almost identical. And so, you know, there might be some differences with some of the software that's installed on top, but the hardware itself is very similar, which means that if your application is going to work on one device, more than likely it'll work on another. So yeah, I think that this is exaggerating things just a bit, because it certainly sounds sexy and scary to say that there, you know, are almost 19,000 different and distinct Android devices on the market.
Yeah, and if you're watching the video version, you saw that chart that Jason threw up there, which is really scary. It basically color codes all the different varieties, and it just makes it look like an impossible. Where there it is.
This is one of them. This is more brand fragmentation. But again, Christina, you totally read my mind as far as that's concerned. So much of the hardware in Samsung devices, for example, which is like half of this chart, is similar, right? So if developers are targeting the hardware in a Samsung device, they're covering close to half of the devices out there, theoretically. And, you know, Google has also done a lot to kind of help developers around this anyways. Like, yes, there's device fragmentation and the fact that there's a lot of different devices there. But Play Services, you know, brings a lot of those services into all those devices regardless of their configuration, because Play Services packages a lot of those APIs that developers can target. And so it kind of makes this a little bit less of a point and, easier scaling for large and small screens. Like, that's largely less of an issue now than it used to be. So Google's done a lot of things to help improve the situation. There will always be more Android devices than there are iOS devices. And this will always be a story that we keep resurfacing, because that's what Android is. It's multiple devices. That's kind of the point of what Google did by releasing an open source mobile operating system.
And I think it's worth noting, though, that, you know, Apple is fragmenting, to use the F word again, itself a little bit more, too. You know, I mean, right now you have the iPad Mini with Retina, the iPad Air, the iPad 2, those are, or the iPad 3, I guess, the iPad 2 still being supported. You have the iPhone 4, the 4S, the 5, the 5C, the 5S. We're talking about rumors of two different sizes for the iPhone 6 in addition to whatever they support from before. So, you know, if you really want to talk about fragmentation, it's not really like iOS developers are going to be getting off that much easier, especially when it comes to screen size.
That's a great point. And Jason, you mentioned the dominance of Samsung. The Open Signal report also pointed out that 12 of the 13 most popular devices that they're registering through their system are Samsung devices. So Samsung's dominance is pretty clear. So if you're an Android developer, you know, focus on it. Make sure it runs on Samsung. Yeah. That's all I'm saying.
Well, pretty important. Yeah,
that's right. Well, one interesting feature of Chromecast, which is a small and cheap medium player sold by Google, is that it uses ultrasonic data transfer, which is sound that's outside the range of human hearing. Google is part of a larger trend in the use of ultrasonic technology. Reed writes, Adriana Lee has written on the subject and joins us now. Welcome, Adriana.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me.
So glad you're here. Now, how does Chrome, before we get into the larger trend, how does Chromecast itself use ultrasonics?
Essentially, what it does is it uses the television speakers or whatever audio system you got hooked up to your entertainment system to emit a very high frequency sound. It'll be like 20 kilohertz or more, beyond the range of human hearing. But even though you can't hear it, your phone can't. So what'll happen is your phone will pick up the sound, and it will decrypt the what's the equivalent of a PIN code, and then the authentication happens. So what this allows is people coming to your house and sharing your Chromecast, flinging videos to your TV, but without having to log into your Wi-Fi network first. So it removes that what they're calling a pain point out of the whole equation.
So tell us a little bit about this Elliptic Labs company and what they're up to when it comes to this ultrasonic stuff.
Well, what's really interesting is ultrasonics, the way it's been explained to me is that it allows for proximity detection. So you saw it being used in efforts in like ShopKick and Klinkle, and they're trying to use it, you know, so that stores can identify where you are in this shop. So whatever aisle or department you're in, they can push a promotion to you. Inside your home, what'll happen is, you know, with Chromecast, you've got the pairing. And now Elliptic Labs wants to extend that further. If you're talking about detecting proximity, well, a great place to use that is for gesture control. So that's been one of the hottest things that the tech makers have been hopping onto. And nobody has really managed to nail it. Well, Elliptic Labs had a very strong showing at the Consumer Electronics Show. And essentially what it is it's almost like a leap motion type control system. But instead of using cameras to detect where your hands are and what gestures you're making, it's using ultrasounds. So the sounds get emitted, they bounce off your hands, and the system can tell where your hands are and what they're doing. So when you make a gesture, it knows that you've done that. It can tell what gesture you're making, and it can tie that to a specific action inside, say, your laptop. Pretty interesting stuff. It's kind of futuristic, and a lot of people are kind of thinking about Minority Report when they're looking at this kind of technology. We're not quite there yet, but there are definitely some advantages with this method of gesture control. It's cheaper for the manufacturers. Apparently, it is more accurate, and it's got a wider range. I mean, really, all the cameras, you're going to have to load down any device with a ton of cameras, kind of like Fire Phone from Amazon, in order for it to detect where you are. Well, if you're doing gesture control with your hands, you can actually work around the device a little bit broader, in a broader fashion. So it's kind of an interesting thing. It's a little bit more accurate, a little bit cheaper for manufacturers, and that's why so many of them are very interested in exploring this.
Now, you mentioned that this reminds people of Minority Report. It reminds me of Batman. Isn't this the technology that Batman used to defeat the Joker in The Dark Knight? I mean, it was basically sound to find out where things were, mainly the bad guys. I mean,
well, it makes sense because, you know, actual bats echolocate using ultrasonics. So it makes perfect sense.
Everything about that movie made sense. I love that movie. Anyway, isn't this technology, though, fraught with difficulty? For example, I could use record an ultrasonic, could I not, sound for this show, for example, and control everybody who's listening, control their Chromecast devices?
Well, theoretically, I suppose that's possible, but what would happen is you would need to have something inside those receptive devices that would first know to turn on the microphone to pick up that sound, then know how to decrypt whatever it is that you're sending out there, whatever those commands are. I mean, yes, theoretically it's possible, but there are a lot of layers of complication that make that scenario probably not that likely, I would say, in most cases. But you know, it's technology, and there are all sorts of crafty hackers out there. So it's definitely, security is definitely important for them to keep an eye on.
Yeah, I mean, you were mentioning ShopKick earlier, and I know that when they did their big launch with some of their Bluetooth LE stuff and their ultrasonic things, people very quickly were able to copy the sound that was sending out certain coupons and, you know, replay it back to, you know, any BLE sensor so that whether they were in a ShopKick store or not, they could get the coupon and just continue to kind of stack them on. So there's certainly a lot of security things at issue. People are talking a lot about this when it comes to commerce. You know, I know you're talking a lot about the gestures, but people are talking about this a lot when it comes to commerce. Are there any ways that the data can that's being that shared across can be encrypted and it can be ensured that it's encrypted so that, you know, people could rely on it to do things like payments?
Well, the thing that they are doing, they are definitely paying a lot of attention to encryption. So you're not just sending out an unencrypted piece of data, whether it be a PIN number or something else, or God forbid, you know, credit card data. Whatever data is being sent out there is usually used for authentication purposes. And in that case, what they're doing is heavily encrypting the signal that goes out. And then on the other side, having some sort of technology available that can decrypt that. Now, it's not a perfect technology, and really there is no such thing as perfect technology. So as soon as they lock that down, I'm sure somebody else will find a loophole, and that just seems to be the case. But they are very much paying attention to this. Talking with CEO Layla Danielson over at Elliptic Labs, they have a lot of experts on board that are not only trying to push the research on ultrasonics and how they can use it, but also making sure that it is a very secure way of enabling, in their case, gesture control. But they're also looking at it for different uses as well. Potentially in the future, it could be smart homes. It could be wearables. It could be stuff that you do in your car, anywhere that you would want some sort of proximity detection or gesture control or anything of this nature. So if it's going to show up in your home and your car and pretty much everywhere you are, they're going to need to lock down that security. So right now, the starting point is encryption for sure.
One of the things I learned from your article was that one of the security aspects of ultrasonics is that even though it's not as easy to encrypt as Wi-Fi, it doesn't carry as far. Closing the windows, closing the doors, and being inside of a building pretty much, you know, it ends at the walls for the most part. You can't really pick up enough of the sound outside of a building or in an apartment next door or something like that. Like you can, Wi-Fi just sails right through the walls. And responding to something that I said about adding ultrasonic sounds to this show and trolling everybody who's listening, J&D in the chat room said that most speakers can't broadcast in the ultrasonic range. They're designed, of course, for human hearing. And Javaman in the chat room said that Skype can't handle ultrasonic, the bandwidth. I don't know if either of those are true, but that's what we're hearing from the chat room, just for what it's worth. Now, you also mentioned, finally, one last question for you, Adriana. You mentioned that Qualcomm acquired a company called EPOS or EPOS. Can you tell us about that company?
It was a startup, and essentially what Qualcomm ended up doing with it was, well, we believe, is they adopted their technology in the product that they showed off at the Consumer Electronics Show, the notepad. And so what we saw was an ultrasonic stylus that worked with a tablet. Now, the interesting thing about that was stylus can be very tricky thing to work with. A lot of times they're very thick and they're bulky, the control that you would have with it isn't quite as good as you want. Well, in this case, what they showed off was a fine point stylus that theoretically could actually work even when it's apart from the tablet. So let's say that you're writing notes on a notebook next to the tablet. Well, it's actually possible with this technology that it could pick up whatever it is you're writing and translate that as data. So very interesting things that people are using this technology for.
Adriana Lee is at readwrite.com, and you can follow her on Twitter at @ADRA_LA. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
All right. In just a second, we're going to hear about Apple's upcoming launch and how there may be a problem. And I also have a breaking news story that Ryan Seacrest, if you recall, had an app called Typo that was a BlackBerry-style keyboard. Actually, not an app. It was a hardware device called Typo. It was a BlackBerry-style keyboard. And he is now facing a potential contempt of court charges because he sold thousands of them in defiance of a court order. So we may see Ryan Seacrest in handcuffs any second now. Just kidding. It's probably not that extreme, but that just came in. I want to tell you about Squarespace. Squarespace is the most fantastic place in the world to build a website. And let me give you a proposition here. Most of us have a creative urge. We want to do something creative. Some of us are talented at painting. Others are talented at photography, design. People do all kinds of things that are creative. Here's an idea for you. Try Squarespace as an avenue for your creative energy. Building a beautiful website is super easy, and you can learn so much about it, and it's so enjoyable because it's so easy to do. They have 25 beautiful templates for you to start with, but once you have those templates as a starter, you can modify it creatively and figure out how to build the perfect website, the one that you like the best. You've seen thousands of websites in your life. You know what you like, what you don't like. Build a website to express your passions and your creativity and do it according to your rules, according to your preferences and your taste, and not somebody else's. Squarespace also has a logo creator tool, so you can design your own logo, even if you don't have mastery of the complicated and expensive tools that most professional logo designers use. This is very easy to use. If you want to see just how easy it is to use to build a logo, just go to blog.squarespace.com and check out their video that shows how to use the logo creator tool. If you have a blog and you want to switch, you can just import it directly from WordPress, Blogger, Tumblr, and other blogs. It's so easy to do, and you don't have to sort of leave a note and say, oh, now the blog is over here. No, you can basically, if you're using your own domain name, you can transfer everything, transfer every post you've ever done, and transfer the domain name so that when your readers show up to your blog, they're just seeing the beautiful new Squarespace blog, and it's completely non-disruptive. They just continue to enjoy your blog, but now with a really superior design, superior hosting, and also superior viewing on mobile devices like phones. Squarespace will automatically recreate your website, no matter how you design it, to look beautiful and perfect on a smartphone. It starts at just $8 a month, and that includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. So start your free 2-week trial now with no credit card required and start building your website today. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure you use the offer code TNT. That'll actually get you a 10% discount on the already super low price. And we thank Squarespace for their support of Tech News Today. Well, in a follow-up, Apple is expected to unveil the iPhone 6 on September 9th. But now Reuters is reporting that Apple is having problems with the phone's backlight part. It's not bright enough. And they're scrambling to get enough backlights in time for the launch. So there may be a slight delay. There may not be. We don't know. But we are hearing that they are struggling with that particular part. What a weird part to be delayed with all the really high-tech stuff they have in an iPhone. It's a backlight. Well, we told you back in March about FireChat, which is an app that takes advantage of the wireless mesh networking feature in iOS 7 to allow peer-to-peer messaging without an internet connection. Well, now just in time for Burning Man, which is a giant festival held in the Black Rock Desert in northern Nevada, the company has added a new feature that enables each person on an ad hoc network to establish a unique pseudonym that nobody else can use. In the past, usernames were more fluid, and at large events like Coachella recently, impersonation and overlapping usernames were common. Christina Warren, have you ever been to Burning Man?
I've never been to Burning Man, but a good friend of mine and his wife actually met in person for the first time there, and that's how that was their wow. meeting love story. Yeah, was fell in love with Burning Man.
And they got to go back to get married too, because that's a crazy place that you will never forget for doing anything. Yeah, Burning Man's always sort of been fascinating. I love the pictures that emerge from Burning Man. They're just so dramatic and crazy. But now you don't have to go without an internet connection, or at least without communicating with your fellow Burning Men. Well, in other news, we told you earlier this month about the saga of the monkey selfie. A photographer asked the Wikipedia to remove a picture of a monkey that was taken when the monkey himself pressed the shutter button. There's the monkey there if you're watching the video version. What a smile. Because the monkey took it, the Wikipedia argued, the photo's copyright did not belong to the human photographer who owned the camera. Well, now the U.S. Copyright Office has weighed in on the issue and clearly stated that no matter what, the monkey himself can't own the copyright because he's an animal. But it raises an interesting philosophical question. Isn't the taking of selfies what really separates us from the animals? I think the Copyright Office is being too restrictive here. What do you think, Christina Warren?
It's an interesting question because it's... In all circumstances, the person who takes the photograph, not the subject, is the person who holds the copyright. But if you're the person who took the photograph and you're the subject, then, you know, you should own the copyright of the photo. But what happens when it's someone who maybe can't have a copyright. I don't know. I thought that it was interesting that the Copyright Office very distinctly said nothing about like man or God or beast. And they made it very clear that if something's an artistic work that was formed by, you know, the ocean or by the tides, or if it was something that an animal that can't have copyright took, that there's no way to actually copyright something. I don't know. I think it opens up a lot of interesting questions, but the one good thing I do appreciate about this ruling is that it means we can now continue to post photos of that fantastic monkey selfie.
Yeah, absolutely. It belongs to the world. And, you know, I guess the reason that animals can't own copyrights is that in this case, might assume that the monkey doesn't know that he's taking a picture, but he's smiling. It seems pretty clear that he's doing that. And there's also the issue of elephants who paint pictures and stuff like that.
Right.
I think that they should make this this photograph. Somebody should make this photograph for sale. All of the proceeds should be go to the purchasing of bananas, and they should all be sent to this monkey. That's what I think. This is my opinion.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, thank you. Well, our TNT fan of the day is Stefan Hauk from Vantaa, Finland, who posted this picture on Google+. And there you are, Christina Warren. And there's some kind of stuffed animal there as well on top of a backpack. But this is somebody who's using a mobile device. Yeah. Angry bird, that's right.
Okay. Possibly a little angry.
Yes. Angry that they're not on the show. Yeah. Well, how do you watch or listen to TNT? Just take a picture of yourself or your setup and post it on Google+, Twitter, or Facebook using the hashtag #HowDoYouWatchTNT. And, of course, you can search the hashtag #HowDoYouWatchTNT to see them all for yourself. No waiting. And that is the tech news today. Christina Warren, thank you so much for being our guest co-anchor. Oh, there we go. She's got her own. See? Incredible. Just had it handy. She has it there. Just props.
I did. I happen to just have this here. Yeah, we've got a bunch of these all over the office. So,
besides,
power on, TNT.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So what else are you working on these days, Christina Warren? You're a prolific blogger and writer. What's next that we're going to hear from under your byline?
Well, I've been working on a bunch of stuff, trying to kind of figure out what's happening with Twitter's changes to the timeline. You know, you're being able to see tweets and favorites from people that you don't follow, or you're able to see what people you follow favorite and sometimes seeing tweets from people you don't follow. Twitter has been very reluctant to actually talk about it on the record, but I'm trying to kind of weigh them down. So if you work at Twitter, talk to me because people are concerned. So I'm working a lot on that, as well as just we're about to gear up for IFA and the really big heavy tech season with phones and gadgets happening in the next couple weeks in Berlin, as well as the big Apple launch. So just lots and lots of stuff you can keep checked in at Mashable. I'm also watching the Simpsons marathon of every Simpsons ever that's happening.
You're on
right
it.
Now.
Yeah.
Completely. Like I've been watching, like I've been listening to my iPad like while I'm working, it's just running in the background. It's fantastic. Every Simpsons ever. So for the next 11 days, I'm going to be very, very unproductive. But I'll be tweeting about that a lot. And you can follow me on Twitter at @film_girl.
@film_girl, senior tech analyst at Mashable, Christina Warren. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Mike.
All right. You can subscribe to Tech News Today on Stitcher, iTunes, YouTube, Feedly, Yahoo, RSS. So many ways to subscribe. Go to twit.tv/TNT and choose your favorite way. Follow us on Twitter at @film_girl and also Tech News Today TV. Join our Google+ community. Just search Google+ for Tech News Today. And please send us your thoughts and opinions. Send email to tnt@twit.tv or leave voicemail at 260-TNT-SHOW and might play your voicemail message. Don't miss our evening newscast, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific tonight and every weeknight right here on the Twit Network. My name's Mike Elgin. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll see you Monday.